What's up? Welcome back to Nostalgia. Dave here with another pod. What's going on in pop culture right now? Pretty solid week, I think, this week on the TV front. We have Class of 09, FX series on Hulu starring Brian Tyree Henry and Kate Mara about FBI agents. We have Silo, the sci-fi series on Apple TV Plus starring Rebecca Ferguson, David Oyelowo, Rashida Jones, bunch of people. We have on the music front, G-Idle's new EP from K-pop, as well as Jonas Brothers' new album, The Album, first album since pre-pandemic. So it's been a minute for those guys. And also new business biopic film, BlackBerry, about the rise and fall of BlackBerry that caught me by surprise. So a lot of good stuff here and a bunch of big stuff coming up as summer really heats up for us. So make sure you subscribe, linktree.com/nostalgiapod, youtube.com/nostalgiapod. Make sure you get the pod however you can. Just make sure you get it. Follow the playlist, best songs of 2023, Spotify playlist. See the link below for that. Let me know what's good and let's get into it. What's up, what's my nostalgia? Dave here with a review of Class of 09. The new FX on Hulu series, first two episodes, out now of 8, miniseries starring Brian Tyree Henry and Kate Mara from Tom Rob Smith, directed by Morton Tildum, among others. Obviously, this caught my attention because Brian Tyree Henry is amazing. Just finished up Atlanta, just got his first Oscar nomination with Causeway, one of the best actors we have. His return to FX obviously deserves attention. Also big fan of Kate Mara, who is steadily always good. Her last FX go-around, A Teacher, I was not a fan of, but I thought she was good in the show. But either way, I think both those actors are deserving of attention, obviously. And, you know, you have a lot of good pedigree with this. Of course, Tom Rob Smith is a pretty stacked CV as well as a TV creator, most notably doing the second American Crime Story season, the assassination of Gianni Versace, as well as London Spy. So notable, you know, pedigree all around with this show. And of course, FX has a great quality stamp. And, you know, I was like, oh, FBI series about FBI agents joining the Bureau. Great actors. Sounds good. Sign me up. Sounds awesome. What I was not expecting with this series, and which I think is perhaps going to be a major pain point with this series, is that it has three distinct timelines. And it is very happy and willing to jump between those three timelines. The past, 2009, when our characters are at Quantico, you know, testing to join the FBI. The present, 2023, when they're all like veteran agents in the force. And in the future, which is like 2032, 33, something like that, which is 2034, sorry, where, you know, one of our characters, Tyree Henry's character, is the head of the FBI at that point. There's some like future tech involved, such as Kate Mara having a prosthetic eye. We have this big AI computer program system that is kind of running law enforcement a la Minority Report. So you have three very distinct timelines, three very distinct shows, I guess you could say. And I'm curious if this jumping between timelines will serve its storylines well enough. Because I liked a good amount of what we had. I think not that it's necessarily like anything I haven't seen before, and maybe I'm just a big fan of Tyree Henry and Kate Mara, and that's all that is, but I was kind of into it. So I think for me, it's a bit, overall, it's going to be a wait and see to see if everything can land when you kind of jump between the timelines and maybe not give moments enough time to really build up and stick because you keep jumping around. So we'll see about how that goes, you know. If you think about the three timelines, I guess that's how you have to do it, where the reformers, you know, I think they're, I've only seen two episodes, of course, out of eight, but they're largely giving a similar performance throughout. You know, the makeup's a little bit done in the future timeline to make them look a little bit older. They more or less look the same, though. Tyree Henry, he just has a great presence, as we know. He's able to command, I think, a lot of emotion and presence, even when he's not laying it down a ton of lines like he is in this show. He's a great actor. I think the Quantico stuff is the most fun, probably because it's also the most familiar, like just watching like agents like try and pass the test, try and succeed, you know, in class. We know that how that feels, but it's enjoyable. You know, the present timeline, there's this kind of like growing like white nationalist threat, kind of Amon Bundy-esque, like anti-government people. We'll see if that lands, but obviously it's pretty tropey, pretty timely, unfortunately, as well. We'll see how that sticks in the future. You know, the AI stuff could come across as quite timely, given the rapid advances in artificial intelligence and in our public lives the last, you know, year or so. But this kind of thing, you know, in terms of Big Brother, Minority Report, people getting arrested for things they think, not necessarily things they've actually done yet, but things they will do in the future. That's all been done before in science fiction. Like that, none of that's necessarily new. So the execution will need to be strong, I think, to make it stand out. That's not something we usually say about FX shows. FX is such a consistent quality track record at this point that this kind of wait and see feeling, I think, has been uncommon. So overall, I think it's a wait and see show. There's enough that interests me about this stuff that even if it's not the most like riveting and like thematically original thing I've ever seen, I'm going to at least stick it out and see how it goes. So that's how I'm feeling about Class of 09 right now. We'll see moving forward. But let me know, how are you feeling about those first two episodes? You like it more or less than me? Are you going to stick around? And for more TV reviews, subscribe. And I'll see you next time. What's up, Womack Nostalgia? Dave here with a review of Silo, the new science fiction series on Apple TV Plus, starring Rebecca Ferguson, as well as David Oyelowo, Rashida Jones, Common, Tim Robbins, Will Patton, pretty stacked cast. Based off a book series, this is from Graham Yost, notably the creator of Justified, a lot of pedigree. And also, I think, kind of in line with how Apple has been making a lot of series lately. Like, this kind of brand of series, in this case a dystopian science fiction series, adapted from a successful novel series, kind of in line with what they've been doing with other stuff, right? Think of Invasion and Foundation, there, and even C, you know, back in the early days of Apple TV+. This seems to be a bit of their MO, but Silo, I think, you know, two episodes premiered last week. We have the third one out now. It's going to be a 10-episode first season. I thought it was pretty engaging and definitely kind of rose up above a lot of the other sci-fi dystopian stuff we get these days. I was pretty compelled and I'm pretty interested in. I thought it was a pretty good start. Definitely sucked me in. You know, I think what's great about this series is it has a really awesome plot line, really great pitch, right? We have this underground cylindrical silo, this society of 10,000 people all living there. They don't really know what happened in the past with human history, but they've been forced underground due to the toxic environment, so they've been told. And as you might imagine, there seems to be a class system rising up. People towards the top of the silo are more well-off and more successful than people at the bottom, grinding. Some familiar science fiction tropes for sure there. But the production design of the silo itself is incredibly engaging. It looks awesome. I'm curious like how big and expansive the sets were they made for this series, because I think it really is engrossing and really brings you into the world. And also, kind of the questions, right? As these the characters we get to know start to realize and question what they've been told about the history of the silo and the history of humanity. Why are they being silenced or misled by this kind of like judicial branch of the silo government, basically? What's going on? What's being hidden? Again, not like that's a brand new phenomenon for like sci-fi rising up series. You know, think of Brave New World on Peacock, for example. We've seen that before. But this, I don't know, just like kind of like the plot mechanics of like figuring out what's going on, the procedural nature of trying to get to the bottom of the mystery. I'm pretty engaged. I'm pretty activated on this, you could say. Like, I want to know what happens. And I think when you have it anchored with just a really stacked cast, right? Obviously, people know Rebecca Ferguson at this point, most famously for Mission Impossible, as well as Dune. She's an awesome actor. And she's the lead of the series. But what's so funny and compelling about Silo is how long it takes to get you to Rebecca Ferguson. We don't really meet her to the end of episode one, and we don't really spend any time with her until episode two. We start out with David Oyelowo, this like sheriff character, and his wife, played by Rashida Jones, and we think they're going to be the leads, and we find out what happens to them. You know, they both begin to question what's going on, and I really like how like the show doesn't bog you down in like tons of exposition. It actually kind of tells you stuff I think a bit more through like direct action, like learning Rashida Jones' character, learning that her birth control was not actually taken out when they were given permission to have a birth. But before that, right, you learn that this is a society where they control births, this is a society where they give people permission to have kids and increase the population. There's all these kind of like jobs people have. Like, I think it really does a really good job of kind of communicating how things work while still having a lot of questions. And naturally, like, you're spending time having that skepticism as the characters are getting it. And I think the question will be with how successful Silo ends up being through this first season. Maybe there'll be more, there's more books, but it's a 10-episode season. Is it going to feel like some Mystery Box shows have felt in the past, where it feels like the show is just kind of withholding information to the viewer for the sake of revealing it at a later date? Hopefully it doesn't feel drawn out. Hopefully it continues to feel compelling going through the motions with this series as things get to be uncovered. Hopefully the, you know, production design and the, you know, the acting on the back of someone like Rebecca Ferguson is able to carry that. We will see. You know, if Harriet Walter in a supporting role, if Ian Glenn in a supporting role, I think Will Patton through the start of the series has been quite strong as another deputy character. He's just a really like humanistic actor. I think he fits right in to this world and this story that we're learning. And, you know, episode 3, I think the kind of race against the clock to fix the generator, or the silo will lose, you know, electricity forever and everyone will be stuck in the dark. Like, incredibly compelling and the kind of like visceral filmmaking as we watch this kind of like hard-nosed group of mechanics led by Ferguson try and get the job done and like save the group, basically. That was quite compelling and fun. And there's obviously just a lot of unknown with the plot, and hopefully everything else continues to be consistent, because I don't think plot alone can carry a show like this. I think we've seen that recently. There's been a lot of shows of a similar substance, as I've said, but not all of them last because they don't have enough beyond just plot mechanics. Silo seems to have enough story to put along with that plot, and we will see how that lasts. As I said, it's a long season, but I'm certainly compelled thus far and looking forward to seeing more of Silo. Definitely the best Apple TV Plus show I've seen this year, because Ted Lasso stinks. But how are you feeling about Silo? For more TV reviews, subscribe, and I'll see you next time. What's up, welcome back to Nostalgia. Dave here with a review of Blackberry, the new business biopic film from indie filmmaker Matt Johnson about the rise and fall of Blackberry, starring Jay Baruchel and Glenn Howerton. This is a film that really snuck up on me, getting a small, limited-ish release this past weekend after premiering at Berlin. And, you know, Matt Johnson is someone I wasn't super familiar with. He's like a true independent filmmaker, but he actually also plays a role in this film as well, acting role. And I thought this was just a really tight, super compelling, well-made biopic film. You know, if you think about this type of storytelling, very popular these days, very common, right? Just recently, we got on Apple TV Plus, we got the Tetris film with Taron Egerton. We just got Matt Damon and Ben Affleck's Air about Air Jordan. You know, this is a pretty common thing. Of course, people know stuff like The Social Network, which is very similar to this Blackberry film, of course. Steve Jobs. It seems that the tech world and like business exploits is like a sub-genre, like mini real-life IP that is starting to get quickly mined. Books about these topics are being quickly picked up to be adapted, because I think there's a lot of confidence from studios that they can get people to watch stuff like this. And Blackberry, I think, is one of the best examples of this I've seen in a long time. I thought this movie was both funny and just consistently riveting, which I also thought was incredibly impressive. You know, think about a movie like Air. We know what happens with Air. We know Nike wins. We know what happens with Air Jordan, how successful it is. But the movie's well made enough and the writing is strong enough that you're still compelled and entertained by the film. Blackberry is very similar. We know what happens to Blackberry. We know that Blackberry rises up out of nowhere, basically, to dominate the nascent smartphone business, and then eventually gets its lunch completely stolen by Apple and Android. We know what happens to Blackberry. And even though we know the finish line with this film, it's still just so riveting. And I think that just speaks to how well it's made and how it kind of subverts some of your expectations along the way, along that journey. I think the acting performances are really good. You have Jay Baruchel as Mike Lazaridis, one of the founders of Research in Motion, the company that would become BlackBerry. He's joined by Matt Johnson's character, Douglas Fregan. They're kind of the co-founders. And they, through chance, basically meet up with Glenn Howerton's character, Jim Vasili. And Jim is not a tech person like Mike is. Mike is a very intelligent tech developer, but Jim is a cutthroat businessman. And they kind of need each other to make something like this work. So they become co-CEOs of Research in Motion over in Canada, and eventually become BlackBerry. And due to superior design and, you know, Mike and his, you know, team of Canadian developers, their true design passion and design acumen focus on creating parts locally, not, you know, outsourcing out to like Foxconn in China to save money, but really focusing on quality design, quality product, and of course combine that further with Mike's true genius, you know, being one of the first people to really tap into how networks work. And now you can kind of basically use data, that whole concept of using data in a smartphone and not having that tax cell signals the way phone calls and traditional text messages do. You know, the development of BBM as an instant messaging service, it's all pretty compelling. But like, the way they have Mike communicate stuff with his genuine like intellect about the technological aspects and the design of this sort of thing is really compelling. You know, when they basically design program Verizon's towers to better suit their products as they rapidly explode in success and popularity. It's all handled in a really, I think, engaging and fun way. You know, think of a movie like Social Network, right? When things are going well, the movie is a rip-roaring time. That's kind of what happens with BlackBerry too. And it's really fun, I think, to be with Mike when he starts to win, because you see the intelligence. And I think what's great about the structure of this film is as things start to flip, you know, they rapidly expand. Jim, you know, has that reputation from the beginning as being a very cocky, arrogant, aggressive person. And now that he has all this success and all this money, he's turned that to some of his personal uses, whether that's abusing an assistant or aggressively pursuing purchasing a hockey team in the NHL, things like that. Mike, starting to get a bit arrogant in his design philosophies and his belief in his own techniques. And it all kind of builds up to, you know, the inciting incident, the bomb, if you will, when Apple in 2007 unveils the first iPhone, the famous Steve Jobs presentation. And all these people at, you know, BlackBerry watching that presentation and like seeing the full screen, no tactical keyboard thing. And Mike just having the complete wrong read on that people would like that, and that would be the future, right? The focusing on the BlackBerry click, that's what people like. And it's like kind of depressing, but you can't help but look away, car crash style of storytelling, where it's like, man, you had it so right and you just could not adapt. You just made bad decisions and you let yourself get passed by. I think the movie does a really good job with managing that transition. You know, early in the film, BlackBerry's under threat to be hostile, taken over, not by Apple, but by Palm Pilot. You have Cary Elwes playing the CEO, Carl Yankowski, in the process. That's a really fun scene. But yeah, I mean, it's just, I think, fun to have like the time capsule of remember when Palm and BlackBerry, and even like, you know, I guess you think of like HTC as well, just like the earlier phone manufacturers, right? Just back in the day, you know? It's fun. Also, I think Matt Johnson is really underrated as Doug Fregan. You know, the Doug character starts off, he's kind of the goof, right? Like, he's the one who kind of builds up morale at Research in Motion, while Mike's kind of the tinkerer, the real, you know, technical thinker. Doug, you know, hosts these movie nights and kind of runs like a goofy developer bro culture kind of thing with his fellow devs. And when Jim shows up, he wants to put an end to that because it's not professional. And you think this is going to lead up to Doug and Mike having a divorce because Doug just won't get on board with the new program and will get in the way. That's not actually what happens. Funny enough, as the movie progresses and things start to go bad, you realize that Doug is kind of the last person who had the original DNA of the company and like the original good intentions left, as Mike has kind of been consumed by being a CEO and having to worry about financing so much and then getting left behind as Apple takes over. Doug is the one who kind of, I think, kind of maintains the soul at the end. So it kind of flipped my perception of what would happen with that character and how I felt about that character. In the beginning, you don't really like Doug. You know, you feel like he's getting in the way. And at the end, you actually sympathize with Doug as things start to go bad. So yeah, I think BlackBerry, sneaky film, you know, didn't have a big box office. It certainly won't. But it'll be on VOD soon. I'd recommend people check this out, this type of movie that you're into. I think it's incredibly well done. And for more movie reviews, subscribe, and I'll see you next time. What's up, Mike Nostalgia? Dave here with a review of Idol's sixth EP, I Feel. Yes, Idol, the G is silent. Funny, odd name they have, but Idol, successful K-pop group, five-piece from Cube Entertainment, one of the smaller K-pop labels, or at least not one of the big four. And despite it coming from a lesser company in terms of stature, you know, Idol is finding, I think, a lot of success. They started back in 2018. This is their sixth EP. But, you know, they got their first top 10 last year with their fifth EP last fall. And they have, you know, 8 million monthly listeners on Spotify. That is no small feat, I would say, for a K-pop group. Just in general, you know, those are pretty solid numbers, really comparable to a lot of other groups of a similar stature coming out in similar time. And, you know, I didn't really know what to expect too much going into this Idol drop, just really getting into them. And I was quite impressed and pleased with, I think, the strength of the production on this. I was really just taken with how often Idol brings in like rock production, just their heavy presence of guitar and drums. Not nearly as common in like mainstream K-pop music, at least not with any regularity. Obviously, I hear it sometimes, but to have an album, or in this case an EP, really like focused on, I think, this kind of theme really worked for me. I thought it was a pretty fun listen. Obviously, as an EP, it's short and sweet, to the point. This one, only six songs, 17 minutes, but the concept is kind of fun too. Like the members are all kind of like playing up like Mean Girls-esque characters, kind of satirizing that and really capturing that with the lead single, or sorry, the title track, Queen Card, which is a super fun boppy song, has a very noticeable guitar line, super up-tempo, clearly like satirizing stuff with those lyrics. And that one's really fun. The only knock I would have on it is like the hook is almost a bit undercooked. It's a bit like just chanty is like the vibe, you know, it's not quite as strongly written, I would say. The second song, though, which is the lead single, Allergy, also like that quite a bit. The guitar line, super noticeable. And ultimately, that gives you like a 2000s emo pop vibe, not something I expected to hear from a 2023 K-pop release. Again, the tempo is awesome. Track 4, All Night, also like that one quite a bit. Really nice drum tempo again, which then leads into that drum tempo, having guitar joining in. It just sounds really awesome. Fun beat. But some of the lyrics, especially with the hook, are a bit repetitive again. Like, I just would have liked it to be a little bit more developed. Production-wise, I thought Peter Pan was pretty cool, too. Like with that hand clap, really nice. In general, I think what's pretty cool about Idol as well is that these artists are super involved in the songwriting and production of their music. We know that's not super common with K-pop, and we know when K-pop artists are involved in the creative process directly, it's not nearly as overt. But in this case with Idol, like Soyeon is the sole writer of Queen Card and Allergy, and one of two writers on Lucid, and wrote on Paradise and Peter Pan as well, five of the six songs. That's super uncommon for K-pop to have one of your members be the sole creative force, especially for a youngish group, you know, on their first contract. Have that much creative control probably speaks to a group that's on a smaller company having that much more creative autonomy. We would love to see this, you know, across the industry. We know it's not common, but I think you know, Idol, it's cool that they're kind of rising in the US and just worldwide in general, you know, because they have a lot of competition, and Cube doesn't really have the marketing might the way the big four labels do. But despite all that, you know, they're finding their way, similar to how like an act like Dreamcatcher is finding their way on a smaller label. So you always like to see that, like to see that competition. And I think my biggest gripe with them is that I think the name is just super confusing and hard to say. You don't say the G. It's a series of acronyms and hidden meetings. IDLE, IDLE, silent G, whatever. Shout out IDLE. I feel pretty solid release. K-pop's been hitting pretty hard so far this year, halfway through May. But let me know how you feel about this one. For more music reviews, K-pop reviews, subscribe, and I'll see you next time. What's up, all my nostalgia? Dave here with a review of the Jonas Brothers' sixth album, The Album. This is their sixth album, but really their second album since ending that hiatus, signing Republic Records, and getting back together as a group in 2019, when we got Happiness Begins, which was a huge smash hit album. Really kind of came out of nowhere, that success to me. You know, selling like 400,000 units first week, several singles going multi-platinum, like Only Human and Sucker and Cool. And Jonas Brothers kind of reestablishing themselves really quickly as a, you know, arena act, a huge pop force. You know, not the biggest force in pop, but a significant one nonetheless. And, you know, since then, that was pre-pandemic. We've been waiting. You know, Nick had a solo album come out, Spaceman. But I think ultimately this is a group, and the Jonas Brothers as individuals, this is a group that they're just better together, like a lot of groups are. And I think the music is at its most interesting when they're together. In the case of the album, I think this is a really safe record where it doesn't really like push any boundaries. Not that it doesn't have sonic inspirations. I think that's probably the best thing about the album. You know, taking a lot of funk influence. You know, the Jonas Brothers have done a lot of press for this record. Went to a bunch of sporting events like the NFL Draft, Knicks, and Lakers game. They've been around, and yet they have really kind of had the same tenor in how they talk about this music. You know, citing Stevie Wonder, citing the Bee Gees. Hall & Oates comes to mind when you listen to some of this music. Clearly the influence is there, and like I think that's the most fun stuff about this music, because lyrically, they're a safe group. I think at their worst, they can be a bit vanilla, a bit plain. But on the other hand, it's like pretty solid music. It's always quite listenable. I think vocally, Nick is always the most engaging of the group. That's really nothing new. Some of the music he's able to belt it out a little bit more, just kind of get a little bit raw with his vocals than Joe really can, you know. And I think this is, you know, kind of just a solid record. I don't know if there's anything that really like rises up and like is like a true earworm the way like Only Human was on the last album. I don't think we really get there on this, but I still think there's a, you know, handful of songs I quite enjoyed. I think one of the early singles, Waffle House, actually kind of stood out to me. I like the vocals on that. The call and response to that chorus, I think, is really fun. I think, you know, starting towards the top, you know, Montana Sky, the brothers sound really nice there vocally, like, you know, just harmonizing together, kind of simple stuff. But Americana track 5, I really like the tempo on that, more of an acoustic vibe instrumentally. That one's fun. I think one of the best songs here would be track 6, Celebrate. The Nick vocals have a bit more punch to those, but the horns really stand out on that track. And at this kind of the part where point where the album changes, because you have Celebrate and Waffle House back to back. I think Vacation Eyes, track 8, is also pretty solid. The bass, I believe it's Kevin on bass, sounds really good, but it's like a slowdown, you know. I think overall, like throughout this album, there's like some fun vocal effects that the brothers do, whether they're like almost like ad-libbing each other as they sing verses or parts of verses, or even just doing like little bits of like overdubbing and stuff, having these like other choruses and other voices brought in as well. It at least keeps you a bit engaged the whole time. And what's kind of fun about this album too is it's quite brisk. You know, it's 12 songs, 32 minutes. It's quite quick. And I think that's why it's like hard to be too critical of this, because it's like it's pretty solid, pretty quick, has some fun moments, you know? And I think if you're a Jonas Brothers fan, this will probably just kind of satiate the need. Not, like I said, I don't think it really hits the highs of some of their past work and even, like, you know, earlier hits, you know, like the True Bangers, like an SOS. Like, there's no SOS on this. That's okay, though. Like, I think, you know, all three of them now are parents and all married. You know, they're probably in a different stage of their career, but interesting to see them on, like, the promo run with this, because they've been heavily promoting this album. And the singles, you know, Waffle House, as well as, I believe, Wings, haven't really taken over the way, like, when Sucker came out. That was a huge hit, like, right away. You know, this album seems to be coming with a lot less fanfare. So I'm curious to see how this goes for them overall. You know, I think another song I like, track 10, Summer Baby, I think the synths really stand out there on that one. Fun vocal performance. Almost Charlie Puth-esque, and which kind of reminds me or made me think of, like, imagine if Charlie Puth wrote the lyrics for some Jonas Brothers songs. Because I think Jonas Brothers, the weakness of their music, if you want to pick a weakness, is lyrics. You know, they, like I said, they're plain, they're vanilla, they're not overly ambitious with their songwriting. If you had someone who's like a songwriting savant, like Charlie Puth, punching up their music, that'd be pretty cool. And I think the Jonas Brothers, even though they're signed to Republic, they work with plenty of producers. You know, John Bellion is a key influence on this album. He produced almost every song. I believe every song, actually. It seems like the writing is still brothers focused, right? All three of those guys are credited on every song, but there's other people involved. I'd be curious if they had someone with like a clear point of view involved. I'd be curious if their creative process would change all that much. Best pie in the sky idea. I don't think anything, something like that would ever happen, but just the thought I had, because that song, Summer Baby, kind of reminded me of like a Puth song, a Puth performance, in a sense. Little Bird, I think Nick sounds really good, really kind of belting out, getting a bit raw, a bit more emotional with his vocals than he did on most of the album. Yeah, so overall, I think it's a pretty solid album, and I'm really just curious about how this performs and what's next for the Jonas Brothers. I can't imagine they would take another, you know, 4 years off from making music, assuming they want to continue their careers as major pop forces. I assume they do. So we'll see what's next for the Jonas Brothers, but let me know how are you feeling about this album. And for more music reviews, subscribe, and I'll see you next time.